You are listening to The Grandest Tour by The Cycling Podcast. Brought to you by iWocker. Flexible loans built for small businesses. iwoca.co.uk.
Hello, my name's Richard Moore, and tonight I'm joined by LB.
Hi, my name's Lionel Burney.
Oh. LB.
Oh, hello. Two LBs. I'm Giro Rosa stage winner Lizzie Banks.
Oh, oh yes, dear. Excellent. Yes, well, Lionel Burney, everyone knows Lionel. Lizzie, you're joining us tonight, one of our guest presenters. You present Service Course for us as well, and you've got a sideline as a professional rider yourself. Well, we had the very sad news last week about your team. Equipe Polkas is no more. You are currently, I guess, between teams, but you have a new team for next year. You can't tell us yet who it is, but you'll be continuing the peloton next year.
I will be continuing in the peloton next year. I can't tell you yet, but I can assure you that the Cycling Podcast will be the first to know when everything is signed, sealed, and yeah, ready for next year. But it's been a hard time, but it's exciting. Looking forward to next year.
Absolutely. Well, yeah, hopefully that'll coincide with one of your days joining us on the podcast, on our coverage of the Giro and the Vuelta. You are rotating with Francois Thomazeau and Ian Boswell, and we've got you lined up for quite a few stages. Lots to talk about today. We didn't think there'd be a lot to talk about today, but there is. An unusual kind of drama in Italy at the Giro, and the Irish celebrations continue in Spain at the Vuelta, second consecutive Irish stage win over there. And we're going to hear from some of our audio diarists today as well on exactly what happened at the Giro today. But what are the headlines from the day, Lionel?
Well, the headlines, I suppose we start with last night and the news that there had been an adverse analytical finding, two, in fact, for the Italian rider Matteo Spriafico of Vini Zabu for a substance called Osterine, which I gather has been, well, it's similar to an anabolic steroid, and I gather it's been used in sports like mixed martial arts and things that I'm not terribly au fait with. So Spriafico is out of the Giro, of course, and well, we probably would have talked about that a bit more had today's stage of the Giro not been quite so extraordinary. It was supposed to be 258 kilometres from Morbegno to Asti, but after three consecutive six-hour days for the riders, well, 6 hours for the winning riders. I mean, riders who were sort of half an hour off the back had even more time in the saddle, and then you've got to add on the neutralised sections as well. We heard James Knox saying that he was on the bike 7 hours yesterday. Well, the riders didn't want to do 258 kilometres, and there was quite a to-do at the start. We'll talk all about this in part one, but the upshot was that the stage was shortened to 124.5 kilometres, and it was won by the Czech rider Josef Černý, who was a very brief leader in the time trial stage a few days ago, a week or so ago. He rides for CCC, of course, and he got into quite a sizable break that went clear. Bora Hansgrohe were chasing pretty hard, but on their own, and well, they eventually gave up that chase, and the break got away and got a lot of time, and then there were several attacks and it all broke down, and Černý, a good time trialist, soloed away to win the stage. But it's all about the shortening of the stage. That's the big story of the day, and we will hear from some of our diarists, of course. And as you say, Rich, over in Spain at the Vuelta, a second consecutive victory for Irish riders. Yesterday, Dan Martin, of course. Today, Sam Bennett added to his collection of Grand Tour stage wins.
You are listening to The Grandest Tour by The Cycling Podcast. Brought to you by iWocker. Flexible loans built for small businesses. Join 50,000 customers taking on life's twists and turns and scaling new heights with iWocker. If you run a business, find out more at iWocker.co.uk. iwoca.co.uk.
Thank you very much indeed to our headline sponsor, iWocker. If you run a small business and you might be interested in finding out what iWocker can do for you, in the form of a loan or a CIBL, that's a coronavirus business interruption loan scheme, loan, go to iwoca.co.uk, iwoca.co.uk. And thanks very much to Iwoca for their support of the Cycling Podcast and their support of other cycling initiatives as well, including Kendall Cycle Club up there in the Lake District. As you said, Lionel, the big talking point today was at the Giro and the rider protest, which has caused, well, I like your expression, a to-do. There was quite a to-do, wasn't there? Mauro Vegni, the Giro director, very, very unhappy and pretty fiery, pretty fired up at the finish. They've confirmed or announced tonight no prize money today for the riders. They're donating the money instead to a hospital. Now, that feels that nobody will criticise that decision. But it doesn't perhaps matter too much in the grand scheme of things, but there is a real sense of enmity, of opposition, of division between the riders and the Giro at the moment, or certainly a lot of the riders. Let's hear from three of our audio diarists, James Knox of De Koenig Quickstep, Joe Dombrowski of UAE Team Emirates, and Rick Zabel of Israel Startup Nation.
So ironically, today was one of the days that we kind of marked as being probably the most boring days of the Giro. It was a bit strange to see a 260K totally flat stage stuck in the middle of week three in between some pretty hard mountain days. But in the end, it was actually a pretty interesting day in that I wasn't aware before the start that there was any talk about shortening the stage. I wasn't on the CPA WhatsApp group, but about an hour before the start, we got a message that was being talked about.
Yeah, what happened? I think it's quite simple. We were sitting in the bus, looking outside. It was raining. It was quite cold, and we went to the start line. I think we arrived there 10 or 15 minutes before the start to do a team presentation, and then there were already a few guys in the tent, and everybody spoke with each other and said that this is bullshit, because I did stage 16 was 6.5 hours, stage 17 was 7 hours. Yesterday, up to the Stelvio, with riding back from after the stage to the hotel, was in total 7.5 hours. So today we were on stage 19, a stage which was 258 kilometer, with 4 kilometer from the bus parking to the sign-in, and 7K neutral, I think. So we end up something over close to 270 kilometer today, which is a joke, on stage 19 on the 23rd of October. I mean, that's my honest opinion. I don't know what Mauro Vegni and the RCS is thinking.
Plenty of talk about today, as we all know. Been a roller coaster. It's really been a roller coaster today. Sat here pretty happy with how things turned out, I'm not going to lie. Won't hold back. Feel like this was a victory.
Doing a stage like this, I mean, it was pen flat. It was boring like hell. Nobody wants to go on the breakaway. Nobody wants to chase. It was shit weather. Nobody wants to watch a race like this on TV. Just a very, very stupid stage. I mean, this is just 30 kilometers shorter than Milan-San Remo.
You know, I guess to preface my thoughts, I don't know if it was the correct decision or not. I know it was. It sounds like the riders started talking about it last night. But of course, the race route of the Giro was released, I don't know, 3 months ago. So maybe it could have been raised then. As for why, you know, this third week, now it's been altered due to the COVID situation. Tomorrow's stage is going to be shorter and less climbing. But, you know, every day this week, the stage has been over 6 hours. And that's for the guys winning the stage. You know, the guys in the gruppetto, they're at 7 hours on the bike. We've had long transfers before and after the race. I think just about every day this week, our wake-up time has been 6:30 in the morning. And then, you know, you have 6 or 7 hours on the bike, another long transfer, and you're finishing dinner at 10 at night. And it gets to a point where, you know, you have a 7 hour stage, but there isn't even time to get 7 hours sleep. And, you know, I saw comments from fans that, you know, well, I get up and work 6:30 every day. And yes, I understand that. But, you know, in my opinion, the stages in this third week are just a bit too long.
I'm not really big into politics and keep my head down, but as far as I'm concerned, there was a bit of chat yesterday already about, well, I think anyone who saw this stage in the road book when the race was unveiled, whatever, 5,500 meters days, just 6 or 7 hour days for the final week, and then yeah, this 255 transfer day just for no reason at all. It was a bit of a, yeah, just unnecessary.
Yeah, the more and more riders came to the start line, more and more riders agreed that we don't want to race like this anymore. It's too much. It's too hard. And I think even though maybe not every single one agreed, I would say 80 to 90% had the same opinion and we didn't want to race. And we spoke with the CPA, the guy who was there, and we told them our opinion. Then the RCS came, it was a big discussion, and we riders were one unit, and we said and told them, like, we're not going to race, we want to make a sign here. And of course, the Giro was in big trouble, but after all we went through, I think, it was good that they noticed that they cannot do everything with us riders. We are not in a circus and we are not animals. That's just my opinion.
Well, yeah, we arrived at the start. Everyone did the presentation. We all huddled in the little rider tent, having a cup of coffee, contemplating the day, 260 kilometers to go. A few little whispers, a few little murmurs. And then, yeah, when it was time to leave, we just didn't leave, more or less. Don't need to name names, but a couple of senior riders took control of the situation, spoke to the race organizer, CPA was involved, I'm not sure to what extent, and basically explained that, yeah, we weren't going to ride in the rain for 260 kilometers for absolutely nothing.
Personally, I don't think these long stages add much to the race. If anything, I think it detracts. I think it gets to a point where the riders are so tired that, you know, is it more interesting to watch the 100 meters or an ultra marathon? It's not that the riders see any of this money that comes into RCS from putting a start town that is 250 Ks away from the finish. And maybe the riders would think about it differently if there was more sharing in that regard.
And for all the people who are calling us pussies or whatever, I think they never did professional cycling, or they stopped a few years ago and they forgot how it is to be a professional cyclist. When people say, hey, we knew so long about it, about the stage, it's true, but a Grand Tour is day by day, and especially this Grand Tour with the pandemic and also with the weather, it was day by day, so we could not decide it earlier. And on the other side, the talks about shorten the stage started yesterday in the evening, and the RCS knew, so it's just a lie also that they didn't know about it.
In the end, I think it's better for everyone. I mean, I saw plenty of things written on Twitter, some rather nasty things directed at the riders. I obviously the bike race is a show, but No one's kicking up a fuss over nothing. It's not, you know, and today was never going to be exciting anyway. I mean, the best scenario of today's race was either a head-to-head sprint or a breakaway. Now, that didn't change. And everyone saved a little bit of legs. I think probably make tomorrow's race more exciting. I mean, people might think the race has been disrespected or whatever, but I don't know. I feel like surely having riders with enough left to get out there and race, and not just been shells of a peloton crawling around desperate to make it to Milan. Seems to be in everyone's interest. Yeah, when we were driving in the bus to the new start location, there was fans on the side of the road giving us the middle finger, spitting in the road. Obviously, the Giro is very important in Italy. And here's the important bit. Started, flag dropped, we were full gas, you know. What a change in attitude. I hope everyone at home appreciated that.
I suspect that having a shorter day today will yield more exciting racing tomorrow. And I just think that, you know, within professional cycling, long days have their place, you know, with the monuments. I think having some big mountain days in the Grand Tours makes sense. But at some point, you know, you don't want to be detracting from the racing because everyone's so tired that, you know, you don't see attacks and you don't see explosive racing like you would otherwise see.
Certainly, I feel better now than I did at the start of the day, if that makes it any better for anyone. I've got now hopes and ambitions of being involved tomorrow instead of trying to survive. So yeah, that's my perspective on it.
What we heard there from James Knox, Joe Dombrowski and Rick Zabel. I think we can hear from Mauro Vegni now, can't we?
Arriviamo a Milano e poi qualcuno pagherà. We arrive to Milan and then someone will pay.
Yeah, Vegni on the warpath, isn't he, really? We've not heard the last of this. I mean, it was interesting to get the perspectives of a couple of the riders. You know, I don't think the riders are totally united. We also heard from Jacopo Guarnieri. He sent us in a dispatch from today, and he doesn't really want to say what he thinks yet about the decision of the riders to protest today. And I think we can read into that quite a lot. There were rumours of some riders being unhappy at what some of their peers did. But some interesting comments from James and Joe. I mean, James said that he spent more time on his bike than hours of sleep this week. He also talked about, you know, fans at the side of the road giving them the finger and spitting at the road, showing their disapproval. Dombrowski as well talked about the cumulative fatigue, the long days, the long transfers, the very short windows for rest, and that the riders don't really feel like stakeholders, you know, so they don't have the same interest in, you know, whether towns have paid for the Giro to come as the organisation do. And, you know, I think, I suppose one of the issues here is that the riders do, I think everyone can agree, do have quite a lot to complain about generally. The problem, I think, is that maybe they chose the wrong hill to die on today, because, you know, the distance of the stage has been known about for months. The weather wasn't as bad today as it has been. And I think that, unfortunately, people will look at it in isolation as a protest against today's stage in particular, whereas I think it's a more general protest about some of the demands that have been put on them at this Giro, particularly, you know, in terms of the long days, the early starts, the long transfers on buses, as well as the long stages, and the bad weather in October. I think it's an accumulation of all this. But very interested to hear your perspective on it, Lizzie.
I think it's always going to be a challenge, and times like today, they're going to be so divisive because nobody is ever going to be happy and there are so many different opinions. I do think that teams did have the opportunity to look at this stage and this final week of the race for, you know, the last year now. I think I'm right in saying it's pretty much the same as it was going to be when the Giro was going to be back in May. And so they could have looked at it and they could have said, right, you know, we've got 4 days back to back where we're going to be in the saddle for 6-7 hours. We've got two big fat mountain stages and then a 260-kilometer flat stage. Is this going to be a problem? We can look at the distances for the transfers. We can look at the time. Is there even going to be enough time for the riders to get enough sleep? No. Okay, well, then we need to talk to the organizer and address this situation now. I know it's easy with hindsight to say all these things, but the men's teams do have the infrastructure and the resources to look into these things, and they do very thorough recons, so they really should know ahead of time. I'm not saying that if I were in that situation this morning that I would want to ride for that long in the rain and in the cold, but It was actually still double figures, I believe, at the start. And when they did eventually start on, you know, a course that was less than half the distance of the original course, half of them weren't even dressed properly. They weren't wearing knee warmers, weren't wearing leg warmers. Some of them weren't wearing raincoats. They were only wearing arm warmers and kind of short sleeve gabba type things. So, yeah, I think
the Sunweb guys did try to get the raincoats on, to be fair.
Oh, dear.
Sorry, Sunweb.
Yeah, I mean, it's definitely an issue, and obviously the riders are tired, and I get that. It's really challenging. A Grand Tour is challenging. It's supposed to be challenging. You're supposed to be really on the edge, and it's the strongest man that makes it through and wins the race, and that is all part of it. And I don't know. I don't want to pick a side here, but yeah, I mean, the whole situation was a complete mess this morning. It really was. And now there are so many unhappy parties that it's really a bit of a disaster.
Yeah, I think that's the most unfortunate thing about it, is that this could have been an opportunity for a little bit of unity, a little bit of clear-headedness. But in defence of the riders, they are fatigued, and it's unreasonable to expect them to put together a coherent argument and an alternative plan at, 11 o'clock the night before a stage. I completely get your point, Lizzie, about they've known for a year about the stage. Just to go through the UCI rules, the maximum distance for a stage in a UCI World Tour stage race is 240 kilometres according to the UCI's rule book, and the maximum average daily distance should be no more than 180 kilometres. Now, when the route was originally unveiled last year, about this time last year actually, this stage was supposed to be 253 kilometres. Then when they did all the detailed work putting the route together, they realised it was going to be 258 kilometres. We know that race organisers sometimes take liberties as well with neutralised sections to get in, you know, inside the regulations. So sometimes, although it wasn't quite the case today, sometimes, you know, there can be 20-odd K of neutral. You know, I have some sympathy with the organisers because they are balancing so many different aspects. They wanted to have a stage finishing at Laghi di Cancano yesterday. They want to go to Sestriere tomorrow. The distances between those two have to be covered somehow. There will be contracts with Morbegno and Asti for the start and the finish that have to be honoured, and that will undoubtedly be, we haven't had confirmation, but that will undoubtedly be why the riders got on their bikes, did around 12 kilometres just to go through the motions, really, perhaps give the Giro's organisers a better chance of making the contract stick and getting the money from the host town. But the situation is unsatisfactory because, really, there's just no... no cohesion, no organisation, no real voice for either the riders or the teams. And it always falls on the riders to basically withdraw their labour, which is what they did today. And so they take the flak. They get the middle finger from the spectators who are disappointed. They get the criticism from the media. And I think that you have to, in this case, look at the broader picture. We're at the end of a very strange year. Riders' training had been disrupted for 3 months, perhaps. You know, they went without proper racing for longer than that. Now we've got this absolutely jam-packed season where some guys in this race have had a couple of weeks between the Tour de France and the start of the Giro. And then the race in ordinary times, what is a very challenging final week. I think I'm not surprised, really, that the riders decided that it's just a step too far. 6 hours on the bike for each of the last 3 days. It would have been more than that today, especially if they'd gone slow. I mean, they could have been out there for 7.5 hours or so, couldn't they, if they'd decided that they were going to do the full stage but take it easy. And I suppose we're left in a situation where I agree with all the points you've made, Lizzie, and I agree with your point as well, Richard. It was an unusual one to take the most drastic action on. I mean, you mentioned before we started recording, Rich, the incident with the helicopter right at the start of the race on stage 4, which caused a rider to pull out of the race injured. I mean, you know, that would...
Luca Wackerman. That's right. Yeah, and I mean... There are occasions where you would like to see the riders make a stand and they don't. And, you know, again, I mean, I do have sympathy for the organisation too, and especially I have more sympathy also for towns and villages along the route that would have been getting geared up, prepared for the Giro, visiting maybe schools, doing projects and so on. But we talked about that incident on stage four, and the riders and that team, Vinnie Zabu actually, they were scared to make a protest, and they didn't obviously have the backing of the other riders and teams, and there was a sort of lack of unity then. And I don't think anybody would have held it against them if they had protested after that incident. Whereas here, unfortunately, they've made it quite easy for the organisation and others to be quite critical of this protest. But I would say that they have effectively neutralised a stage that would have been pretty inconsequential anyway. Imagine if they decided to take a stand yesterday and decided they wouldn't race over the Stelvio. You know, they've kind of preserved the integrity of the race. They've ensured that the race will still have, a deserving winner. They have protested at a stage that was always going to be pretty inconsequential.
I think you really need to think about the role of the CPA in all of this, because the CPA is, or at least is supposed to be, you know, the union that represents the riders. And when you're riding a Grand Tour, you are so absorbed by it that you are completely exhausted. And things happen all the time. You know, you have moments where to say you're close to death is not an exaggeration. You know, you have a crash, or somebody nearly hits you with a team car, or I don't know, crazy things happen all the time. And then you just move on from it and you forget about it because you've got so much more to focus on and so everything else in the race to focus on. So this is where the role of a riders' union needs to come in and should be so important, because you should take these incidents, like the incident with the helicopter and the riders, as they did on stage four, you know, they all took to social media and they all said, this is completely not on, this shouldn't be allowed to happen. And then they need to go to the CPA, or the CPA need to take the responsibility to say, right, we obviously there's a situation here that the riders aren't happy with, we're going to take it up, and then we're going to take it to the UCI, because you can't really expect the riders to, I don't know, launch an inquiry or write a letter to the UCI when they're in the middle of a 21-day stage race. They've got so much other stuff to focus on. So again, you know, there were reports last night that the CPA claimed that they actually went to the organisers last night and said that they thought that this was going to be a problem. Mauro Venni, he absolutely denies this. He says that he didn't know anything about this until today. They received no request yesterday. He said, we didn't accept the riders' proposal. We suffered it. And this is what happened when the riders don't show up at the start, and so now someone will pay. So now, because of this kind of lack of communication and maybe lack of responsibility on the part of the CPA, that has just led to another situation where everybody's so unhappy. So can you expect the riders to do everything when they've already got this stress of a 21-day stage race? No, I don't think you can. I think it's also the responsibility of the teams and the union, the CPA.
Yeah, I completely agree with that. I mean, if there was there was enough trust between the riders and the body that is supposed to be representing their interests, then somebody slightly detached from the race but looking after the riders' interests could have made a strong representation. I mean, we did slightly mock Jonathan Vaughters and his open letter last week when he called for the Giro to be stopped on the just before the second rest day, so basically have a two-week Giro. He was making that case on the basis that the coronavirus situation was starting to escalate a little bit out of control again and worrying about the safety of riders and staff. You know, but if there was somebody who had made a strong, clear, point-by-point representation to the organisers last night and said, look, this is what we're prepared to do. I don't know, we'll honour the start, we'll get into the buses, we'll cut out 100 kilometres and then we'll race properly. But this is, you know, this is one stage too far at this length if you want us to race properly in a showcase stage on Saturday. If it hadn't worked and the riders had ended up crossing the line and going from start to finish and doing the whole lot, at least that would then have been kind of on the record as a professionally, properly put together piece of work that then when the next thing comes up, they can go, well, hang on, this is now incident number three in the last 6 months, and start to build up a case file of these kind of incidents, whether it be safety related or just, other things that the riders are not happy with. I think that could have worked, but there clearly isn't the mechanism for that to happen at the moment. There's just no organisation, is there? There's no
trust.
There's no trust.
There's no trust from the riders. And if the riders don't trust their union, then you're not going to speak up when there's a problem. And if the riders don't trust the union, the organisers aren't going to respect the union. And you need to have this cohesion between all of the bodies for it to work. And like you said, we could have had a situation where everybody knew what was happening before the start. There was so much less stress. Whereas actually we had a situation where the riders are waiting in tents. And some of them don't even know what's going on. The start should have happened 5 minutes ago, and they're just waiting there. The team buses have already gone to the finish. They end up getting on their bikes, doing 10, 15 kilometres, by which point they're soaked to the skin and freezing. And as we heard James Knox say, he was like, well, at this point, I might as well just carry on. I'm wet and cold anyway. They get on the bus. Then, you know, you see things on social media where the riders are on the bus. They're scrabbling to find dry clothing because they don't have a second set of dry clothing because they've used all their wet weather gear already. So it's just a disaster.
I also think that people within the sport seem to sometimes forget that they're actually all on the same side. The teams, the Absolutely. Riders, the race organisers, the broadcasters, they're actually all have the same interests. And all that happened today was the sport was brought into disrepute and there's finger pointing and, you know, the riders eventually carry the can again.
I mean, one thing we haven't even mentioned is COVID and that being part of the backdrop to this race and this season. And that, you know, there have been grumbles about the COVID protocols at the Giro. That will have also caused stress and anxiety. And the UCI, in drawing up this calendar, they've asked a lot of the riders and the teams. It wasn't particularly well thought out. It was putting a huge burden on them, and I think they've cracked. And I don't think it's, you know, of course they knew about this stage a year in advance, and they knew about the course when the Giro was announced for October, and they had a broad idea of what the weather would be like, etc. But they didn't know how they would feel on the morning of the 23rd of October when they woke up. They didn't know the detail of all the bus transfers, the time they would spend, you know, getting up at 6:30, spending 2 hours in a bus to the start, another 2 hours after the stage. And so, you know, I think a kind of a protest a month or so ago wouldn't have had any impact. The only time they can, as you said, Lionel, the power they have is to withdraw their labour. The only way the riders can effectively make a stand ever is just by refusing to race. And we've seen that over the years. They've often picked odd things to protest about, whether it be, you know, compulsory helmets or, you know, a stage today that, again, if you look at it in isolation, was one of the, in inverted commas, easier stages. And in weather, as you say, Lizzie, that wasn't all that bad. And that's the problem. They've given the opportunity to critics and to the organisation to say that they were soft and that they made the wrong call today, where I think they do have a legitimate grievance in there, but I don't think that message came across as clearly today as it could have done.
Definitely not. The other thing is, you know, just on the, to go back to the race route, and obviously I've covered the things that the race organisers are trying to balance out. And there's a kind of a tolerance, isn't there? You can tolerate long transfers as long as there's not too many of them. You can tolerate long stages as long as they're not, you know, all in a run like these are. They obviously 258 kilometers. There's no real sporting merit to that. I mean, yes, it will fatigue everyone. It's another long day on the bike. It might, you know, it might open up some gaps when they start racing in the mountains again tomorrow to you know, who's responded and who's recovered best from 7 hours in you know, of a flattish stage. I mean, in terms of the racing, there's no real merit to having a stage like that as stage 19 of the Giro. And just lastly, from me on this idea that, well, it's supposed to be hard. Of course it's supposed to be hard. It is hard, but the racing is much more intense now than it was even 10 years ago, 20 years ago. And so we've got to be careful what we ask of riders here. Do we want to go back to the days when they would just ride piano for 4 hours and then just race for an hour at the end? I don't think we do. I think we've come to like the combination of kind of intensity and endurance, but the endurance aspect doesn't need to be as extreme. And just lastly on, you know, well, they used to do X, Y, and Z in the old days. It's probably important to remember that one of the most famous rider protests in the history of the sport from the 1978 Tour de France, the stage that went to Valence d'Agen in it was stage 12A of the Tour de France, and the riders came into town and they stopped in the finishing straight a few hundred meters from the line, probably 200 meters from the line. They got off their bikes and they all walked over the line in protest at the practice of having two stages on the same day. They'd actually only done that once prior in that Tour de France. That day, stage 12A was supposed to be followed by stage 12B. Well, it was followed by stage 12B, but there was a practice of the Tour de France organisers having two stages in order to double the amount of money they could get in for hosting, you know, charging towns to host the start and finish. And they were asking riders to do 250 plus kilometres by doing two stages. Now, it took a few years, but that practice was basically outlawed and done away with because, well, yes, it gave you two sprint finishes, but it also cut down recovery time for the riders. And probably rightly, it wasn't something that you really need to make the tour harder.
The optics are important, aren't they? And on that occasion, the image of Bernard Hinault as a young rider, but the rider's leader with his sort of chest sticking out, was very important. Whereas today we had riders huddled under tents and Adam Hansen in discussions with the organisation. And that often also is what helps bring about change, is a very strong, charismatic leader. And there probably isn't such a character in professional cycling at the moment.
Where's Fabian Cancellara when you need him? He'd have been, you know, he'd have been down
Lizzie,
at the start.
Lizzie the Badger Banks.
But I think in women's cycling, we don't, maybe you do have voices that will be heard, but I don't think you have voices that will be heard by the organisation because it's so different. We don't really have the power to actually make any difference in a race. We can speak out and we can say in the media that something's not good enough, but really it's a completely different business with women's cycling, and there's so little money in it that trying to get something to change when you think it's not good enough is impossible, as you can see with, you know, the Giro Rosa and the state of the roads. And from day one we said it was atrocious and nothing, you know, it's not like any of the stages got rerouted or anything. We just had to deal with an absolute mess. And, you know, some of the roads that the boys were riding on in this Giro, and they said it was a mess. And I was like, guys, you have seen nothing. You should have seen what we were riding.
Well, I was going to say, Lizzie, your diary from the Giro Rosa was a great listen. That we released that recently. But you also, you know, gave a few interviews about it, and your voice was certainly heard. You know, and it, unfortunately, it takes sort of bravery to do that, and courage to do that, and a lot of riders are reluctant to put their heads above the parapet like that. I mean, how the Giro Rosa, coincidentally or not, has been stripped of its World Tour status for next year. I mean, how do you feel about that now? About being a voice, about being somebody who is not afraid to express some pretty strong opinions in the media, and, you know, does that help you or hinder you as a rider?
I'm not sure whether it helps or hinders, but I mean, I've always been someone who believes so strongly in fairness and equality and in doing the right thing for whatever situation, and I apply all of that to bike racing and to, yeah, whatever situation might arise on the road, whether it's I don't know, fairness in a sprint or whether it's whether or not we should be racing. And I don't know, it's really tough. I don't know. Yeah, I mean, I've had a lot of media attention off the back of saying that, you know, the stuff that I disagree with in the Giro. Obviously the Giro Rosa has been downgraded now. I think it's hard because when you downgrade a race, you know, Omloop-Het Nieuwsblad, for instance, is a 2.1. It's not even 2.0 pro or World Tour, but it's treated like a World Tour race because the riders go and they make it a World Tour race. So if the riders still go to the Giro Rosa, it's still going to be the marquee event because we don't have anything else that stepped up to that level or kind of has the prestige or whatever yet. I think that it probably was the right move to downgrade it because really the safety standards were not good enough. The organization was not good enough. You know, we had situations where you didn't even know where you were finishing in a stage partway through the race. And one stage I found out, you know, 20, 30 kilometers away from the finish from the team car where we were finishing. And he showed me some pictures on a phone out the window. So, I mean, yeah, it's not really good enough. And things need to change, but I don't know who's going to take the responsibility to actually do that. I really don't know.
The Cycling Podcast is supported by Science in Sport. Science in Sport, fueled by science.
Thank you very much to Science in Sport for their support of the Cycling Podcast. Very grateful to them. And if you want your 25% off all your Science in Sport products, go to scienceandsport.com, enter the code SISCP25. I used a few Science and Sport products today on my epic, hashtag epic, training ride.
How long was it?
I did a tough...
258 kilometres.
I can't get 250, plus neutralised section. Yeah. I can't lie about this because I'm on Strava, unfortunately. I was tempted to lie about it. I think in the end, about 60 kilometres.
So you cut it down. From what to 60 kilometres? I mean,
well, I had an argument with Maraveni about it and eventually settled on 60 kilometres. But very enjoyable it was.
It's not supposed to be enjoyable, Richard. It's supposed to be hard.
Oh, it was very enjoyable. It's very enjoyable. Anyway, while we've been chatting, we've just received another view from a rider, and it is a different view. So we thought we'd play it. Cesare Benedetti of Bora Hansgrohe.
And about what has happened today at the start. We Bora Hansgrohe think that it was too late to take such a big decision. We cannot wait until a couple of hours before the start to start a discussion about this topic. The Giro route was presented some months ago, so there was. There was time enough to discuss it if it was necessary.
So Cesare Benedetti of Bora Hansgrohe there. Interesting that he's speaking for his team when he makes his view known that he felt it was all a bit too late and a bit shambolic. But he was a factor in the stage as well. He was the last man into the breakaway today, only to then puncture, unfortunately. So he lost his chance to contest the stage. And we haven't spoken about the stage at all, Lionel, but a very good win and a much needed win by a rider who is out of contract.
Yeah, I mean, there was the break, wasn't there? And then it hovered around sort of a minute and 30, and Bora Hansgrohe obviously had riders, three or four riders on the front of the peloton trying to close the gap. They didn't get any help from anybody else, and people might have been wondering why Groupama FDJ didn't lend a hand, seeing as a likely sprint finish would also have favoured Arnaud Démare. But of course, Demar's got a handful of stage wins already, and probably more interested at this stage in getting the Ciclamino jersey for the points competition wrapped up. And if there was a sprint and anything went wrong, you know, he could have crashed or had a mechanical problem and hand Peter Sagan the opportunity to close that gap or perhaps even overtake him. And so it was left to Bora Hansgrohe. And as I said, right at the start, they gave up the ghost when it was obvious that they weren't going to get the break back. It was sort of, a dozen or so against three or four, and the numbers weren't going to work out for them. And then, Czerny, the rider who got the stage victory, and it's very, very late in the year, but whether that will lead to somebody making him an offer for 2021, we'll have to wait and see.
Well, we're going to go to the Vuelta, but our bridge to the Vuelta is going to take us back to the Giro. Daniel Freib, our man at the Vuelta, a bit more preoccupied today by what was going on in Italy than what was going on in Spain. Let's hear from him now.
Evening, chaps. Evening from the Vuelta. As you can probably imagine, I have been paying a little bit more attention to the Giro, I think, today than the Vuelta, for reasons you can probably guess. My hot take, my instinctive reaction to everything that's been going down today. I think the manner in which the riders communicated their decision, the unilateral decision or desire not to race in the first part of the stage was pretty inelegant. But then on the other hand, people usually do express themselves in a fairly inelegant fashion when they're tired, when they're angry and when they're emotional, which I think is the case for a lot of the riders at the Giro after a very hard final week and a difficult season. There was a bit of, I suppose, triumphalism in some of the messages, the statements I saw from riders, you know, finally we've shown that we can come together. Maybe an apology to the race organisers might have been also in order, but yeah, I do sympathise with them. I think the one misgiving I have is that they've known the route for a long time. We always knew there was a 258 kilometre stage in the last week, and they didn't know that the weather was going to be as poor as it was today, but they've known the forecast for 3 or 4 days, and I think discussions should have happened a lot earlier and should have involved all parties. And you know, I winced slightly when I heard the accounts of the riders getting together in a huddle before the start today and simply not proceeding to the start line. And I can only imagine, well, I don't have to imagine, because Mauro Venier's been very explicit about how he felt. Underlying it all is this sort of fundamental misunderstanding or miscommunication now about what a Grand Tour should be. I think I touched on this a few months ago in the podcast. There's a school of thought, a very romantic, sort of wistful school of thought, that Grand Tours still fit into the realm of endurance sport, and a Grand Tour is a grand journey around the country. And this is, you know, some of the kind of rhetoric that gave birth to the Grand Tours 110 years ago. And it strikes me that the riders don't feel that way anymore. And also, you know, a lot of the messaging they've got from the media and stakeholders and just the way the sport's evolved is much more, or sort of places the Grand Tours much more in the realm of kind of performance sports, where, you know, they turn up to the start like racehorses and they offer a spectacle and then they go home and they try to recover again as best they can. And the geography where they happen to be, whether it be in Italy or France or Spain, is almost immaterial or secondary to the racing and the spectacle that they see it as their duty to offer. But, you know, the Giro, I think, has got confused about what its identity should be. The Vuelta has very successfully over the last few years, two decades, has established its identity as this short, sharp hit of exciting racing, and they are unashamed, unabashed about that. And I think even this year, with the 18-stage Vuelta and hard stages from day one, has even reinforced that, is going to reinforce it. And we're already hearing positive things here from the riders about, you know, this is a blueprint for future Grand Tours. So the Vuelta has done that. The Tour de France is the Tour de France. And the Giro has sort of been scratching around, wondering what it can be. And it has settled on this formula, or it thinks it's settled on this formula of this ultimate test of endurance among the Grand Tours. But I don't think this has been very clearly communicated. It's not been embraced by the fans, certainly. There's also the fundamental question of whether it makes for good entertainment, which of course with cycling's business model is the bottom line. And, you know, even today you heard Mauro Venier talk about the effect a 250-kilometre stage would have had on tomorrow's race, which I fully agree with. But I just don't think that, again, that is really aligned with what people think a Grand Tour is now, what people think a Grand Tour should be, and what the riders want or believe either. As far as the Vuelta is concerned, as I've said, it's been very exciting thus far. An interesting sprint today, downhill sprint, Sam Bennett winning. Standby, I think I said a couple of days ago, I'm getting the sense that the four outstanding candidates for victory here are Rog, Sepkus, Enric Mas, and Richard Carapaz. With the possible caveat that Dan Martin is clearly absolutely zinging at the moment. And effectively, this Vuelta is a 2-week race. two-week GC race with one mountain stage bolted on a few days later, a few days after the end of that two-week race, because week three is pretty benign. There are some flat stages there. So the key is to be good for 2 weeks. And Dan Martin might just be able to pull that off. So there you go, chaps. That's me from the Vuelta. And we'll be updating you further in the next couple of days.
Well, that was Daniel with some interesting thoughts on what happened at the Giro and his sort of helicopter view of the Grand Tours and the Giro's search for an identity. But also, I thought it was a very interesting point. Maybe Lizzie, you've got something to say to this. Cycling as a performance sport rather than an endurance sport. And when I see riders in skin suits and with, you know, very, very aerodynamic road bikes, someone like Mark Hirschi, for example, you know, just a million miles away from the road riders of the, you know, the not too distant past, it has changed. I don't know if you've not been in the sport all that long. Has it changed even in the time that you've been involved, or and do you make that distinction too between a sort of performance sport and an endurance sport?
I think it has changed since I've been in it in the last 5 years, and I think part of that is the perception of what the fans at home are after. And, you know, we used to just be happy watching these really, really long stages of the Tour de France where not much happened. And now, you know, especially after last year's Tour de France, where it was just so exciting, every single race organizer seems to want to tap into that kind of style of, oh, let's create these crazy things that are going to happen in all the different stages. Having said that, of course, today we saw a very traditional stage, 258-kilometer stage, that then got ripped to shreds. But yeah, so there has been a change in terms of what the people want, I think. In terms of performance-orientated or endurance-orientated, I don't really know. I mean, the performance aspect of it is such an important aspect. I don't know. I'm not really sure I can answer that question.
I think you make a good point there, Lizzie, about what the fans want and what the broadcasters want. And I do think that as all sports broadcast models are going through a period of change at the moment, I mean, pay-per-view is a big deal in football in the UK and will become more so. I mean, that's just something they're dipping their toes into now. And I do get a sense that you know, the broadcasters will be calling the shots to a greater degree in years to come. And what will that mean for races like the Tour de France, the Giro d'Italia and the Vuelta? Will we eventually do away with the flat stages? Will, you know, the pure sprinters like Marcel Kittel and Mark Cavendish be kind of consigned to the history books? Because what people want to see is punchy uphill finishes and tricky climbs that break things apart, and maybe the way you know, the product that the fans want will start dictating, because the broadcasters, to an ever increasing degree, will be able to monitor who's watching, when they're watching, when they switch on, when they switch off, and that will inevitably, technology will inevitably start to shape the races that are put on. And I think that we might well see, you know, the Vuelta model. I mean, this year is even more extreme because it kind of got rid of the opening 3 days with the sort of the slowish start with a time trial and then a sprint stage or two. It's going to be an interesting few years. But personally, I like the fact that the Giro does still have that old school element. You know, the length and the endurance of it is part of its character. It's something that does define it and make it different from the Tour de France. I just think that because of the year we've had, because of the time in the year it is, that perhaps somebody should have been thinking a bit more clearly about exactly what it was they were putting on.
I think that there is a way to have both. You know, you can have sprint stages and they can still be exciting. Just don't make them 258 kilometres on the 19th day of a 21-day race. Or, you know, we watched Dipana the other day and it was so exciting. It was a sprint race, absolutely pan flat, but so exciting. The same with Ronde van Drenthe, a sprint race that's so exciting and anything can happen because there's crosswinds, there's interest from other things. So there is a way you can create interest in sprint stages. But the organizers just need to be a little bit smarter about how they do it and where they place these in longer tours.
the Vuelta, and with apologies, because we're not going to spend too long on it, although a great win by Sam Bennett ahead of Jasper Philipsen, who took a bit of a flyer and looked like he might have had it. Just checking on Philipsen, he's been a good prospect. He's still only 22. He's joining Alpes and Fenix for the next couple of years. I'd learned that today. I mentioned the other day what an impressive team they have become, and he will add a lot of firepower to that team, I think. But a fantastic lead out for Bennett from De Koenig Quick Step. And then he kind of lost Michael Morkov in the finale, but improvised and finished very quickly indeed. Pascal Ackermann, who I might have expected to be the quickest there, a bit off the pace, but a very good win by Sam Bennett.
They'd obviously done their recon absolutely perfectly, because I think it was about 2.5k to go. There was an absolutely critical roundabout where you had to go the long way round a roundabout and go three quarters of the way round. And they were first into that with about five men. And then from there, they just led it all the way through. And there were a couple of tricky corners right at the end, and they made sure they were always there. And then, like you said, on the final corner, it looks like he was perhaps going to get a bit boxed in. But yeah, he made it through, and he was just so much faster than the rest of them in the end.
Great week for the Irish.
Pint of Guinness.
How will you celebrate, Lionel?
Well, on Monday in the UK, a Guinness 0.0% non-alcoholic version is being launched of Guinness. I mean, fantastic.
Wow. Perfect.
I imagine Sam Bennett will be drinking that tonight in Spain.
You really know how to celebrate, don't you, Lionel?
Yeah, I do at the moment, yeah. Yeah. I'm quite looking forward to getting some.
That's keeping you going at the moment, is it?
Yeah.
The thought of Guinness.
Yeah, I'm riding
next episode sponsored by Guinness 0.4%.
0.0%.
Well, if you're listening, Guinness.
0.0%. Oh gosh, I'm sorry.
It's absolutely there's no alcohol in it whatsoever. I'm intrigued. Well, I'm doing my grandest tour, Richard. I'm riding on the turbo every day, and it's dehydrating me if nothing else. I'd like to be able to rehydrate with them.
Me and Lionel both boasting about our cycling exploits.
You know, this is brilliant. The riders at the Giro have nothing to complain about. They're only doing 3 weeks. You guys are doing five.
I'm doing five weeks.
Absolutely. Absolutely. Lizzie, are you doing any cycling at the moment?
I'm actually doing zero cycling at the moment. So you guys have got one up on me. You deserve the beer and I don't.
Well,
although I do cycling the other 11 months of the year. So maybe
you can join in our Zwift ride on Sunday morning if you wish, Lizzie.
I think I'm going to be spending enough time on Zwift this off season. So that's very kind of you. But I think I'm going to pass on this one.
Well, if anyone out there would like to join me on Zwift, Richard, are you up for it this Sunday?
Might be tricky this Sunday, but I do intend to join very soon.
Absolutely pathetic. I promise. Absolutely pathetic. Well, if you want to.
Maybe Sunday. It depends. I might not be at home, so I'll see. Well, can I let you know a bit later on?
Yeah, you can, yeah. I'm doing one of my cycling podcast meetup rides on Zwift on Sunday morning, 9:30 UK time. Check out our Twitter feed this evening for a link to apply to enter that. And once it's full, but hopefully see plenty of you on the start line on Sunday morning. We're going to do the Champs-Élysées course on Zwift to celebrate of the Giro. I mean, it doesn't really work, does it? But
yeah, that doesn't really work. I might turn up at the last minute and complain about the distance of the ride.
Well, it's 1 hour. It's 1 hour
and,
to be
and the weather.
1 hour to
I
be
might
reduced.
Turn up and just refuse to ride.
It's going to be 1 hour reduced to 21 minutes.
Excellent. Well, Lizzie, you're going to be joining us again in the coming days, I think, aren't you? You're doing a little shift now, so it's been great having you tonight. And what's more to talk about? Well, tomorrow especially. I mean, we should briefly look ahead to tomorrow's decisive stage of the Giro. Because
big call that, Rich. You know, what about the time?
Yeah, we need to talk about it now, Richard, because I need to get my predictions in, because I want to tell you who I think is going to win the race, and I can't say it afterwards. Okay. So.
No, you can't. Whether it's decisive or not will depend on the time gaps tomorrow night, really, won't it? But, well, what do you think, Lizzie? Three times up Sestria.
Yeah, it's quite interesting because obviously this is a watered-down version of what we had originally. And originally, you know, we were going to be going over the Col d'Agnello at 2744 metres, and that was at 105k into 198, and then over the Izoard at 145k. So that could have really blown the race apart. We saw how Wilco Kelderman was struggling up the Stelvio. And was that partly the altitude? Possibly. So, okay, you've still got altitude tomorrow. They go up to 2,041. It's not nowhere near as high as it was at the Stelvio, and it would have been up the Anulo. But I still think with the first passage of that at 137K, going over again at 163, and then again at 190, I think that he might crack. And we've already seen some, you know, signs of cracks within the Sunweb team. And, you know, they're very much in Sunweb, like, this is the plan, and they stick to the plan. So, I don't know. I think that could be their downfall. Well, and my money is on Teo to take the jersey into Milan.
Well, I mean, if Kelderman does crack, then they won't have done the wrong thing yesterday. And we had a bit of a debate about that. There's been a lot of discussion about what the right thing to do. What's your view, Lizzie? Should Jai Hindley have waited for Kelderman?
Absolutely not. It would have been the most stupid thing they could have done. I mean, why on earth would you wait for somebody who's cracking halfway up the penultimate climb when you've got another nearly hour-long climb ahead of you? They had absolutely no idea if he was going to recover. You've got the virtual second on GC, who, if you lose your leader, is then going to be the virtual first on GC. So why the hell would you wait for the other rider? All he had to do is sit on Teo, sprint past him at the end. And then, yeah, maybe Teo should have given a little bit more up Lago di Cancano climb. But, yeah, it's easy to say from the sofa. He didn't look like he was giving absolutely everything. It looked like he was, you know, holding a tiny, tiny bit back. I have to say, I've been a little bit disappointed with this Giro, that there's not really been any attacking. I'll kind of say that it's been a race of attrition and a race where people come out of the back rather than people making moves at the front. And yes, it's been exciting because people have blown up, but it's not been exciting because people have been attacking. And I really, really hope we're going to see some big attacks tomorrow from Teo, maybe from Jai, and yeah, hopefully shake the race up a bit.
Well, yeah, if Kelderman cracks, then we could see a brilliant race between Hindley and Teo Gegenhardt, because they look very evenly matched. You know, both of them look really good. They look really strong. Yes, they didn't really look in trouble at any point, either of them, apart from putting on the rain jacket.
But
in the case of
Teo's got the benefit of the time trialing on his side, so Teo's going to want to go into the time trial with a buffer over Jai, so he's going to want to attack him, and Jai is going to want to have a buffer because he knows that he's likely to lose out to Teo in the time trial. So I'm really hoping for fireworks tomorrow, and I want to see those attacks that we've missed from, you know, in the last 19 days.
It all hinges on Kelderman, doesn't it? It all hinges on what happens to him and what kind of state he's in. The point you make about altitude is a very, very interesting one as well. So we'll see. I mean, it's tantalizing. Can't wait to watch it. And you'll be joining us again tomorrow night, Lizzie, to sort of chew over the bones of what happened and look ahead to Sunday's final stage. Thanks for joining us tonight, though, Lizzie.
Thanks very much.
Thank you, Lionel.
Thanks, Rich.
Oh, just before we go, sorry.
Yeah.
Sorry. Got to say thank yous to friends of the podcast.
We don't have to. I mean, we choose to. We do so because we like to say thank you.
We're very grateful to them, and we've thanked them very much for their support. Thank you if you've signed up as a friend of the podcast at thecyclingpodcast.com. From me, a big thank you to Reese Lewis, Wesley Cedros, Colm Roach, Neil Geraghty, Bill Jessup, and Dan Rees.
And a big thank you to Alastair MacPhail, Bob McPartland, Dominic Brooke-Reed, Christopher Bracewell, Michael Woods, and Dan Jones.
Michael Woods.
Who knows?
Dan Jones, as of backstage pass fame from Mitchelton Scott.
Michael Woods of EF Pro Cycling, maybe.
Taking time out from riding the Vuelta to sign up as a friend of the podcast, possibly. Or if it's another Michael Woods, thank you very much to you also.
And from me, a huge thank you to Rob Crawford, Martin Neal, Sam Evans, Sam Frost, James Powell, and Glyn Roberts.